3 weeks ago today, a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd, a black man. And now, even as we grapple with what to do in the wake of his death, even as it's still all over the news, we have more. 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks died Friday after an Atlanta police officer shot him. The Fulton County Medical Examiner has ruled his death a homicide. We're talking about the role of police, how the force began, what's broken now, and how we can begin to fix it. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. And our guest this morning is Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. He looks at the intersection of race and democracy and inequality and criminal justice in modern U.S. history. Khalil, thank you for being with us here on the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Keely.
Authorities say on Friday, Rayshard Brooks took a taser from an officer and fired it as he ran away, and an Atlanta police officer then fired his handgun three times, killing Brooks. The mayor of Atlanta has said she's reviewed the video, does not believe the officer could justify that use of force, and that there's a difference between what you can do and what you should do. Khalil, your reaction?
Well, I watched the video, like so many have now seen, and the most striking aspect is that a person fleeing from a police officer with their back away from them clearly is not a threat to the police officer. So then the question is it in our collective interest as a society to kill a person because they might get away? They might outrun the police when, in fact, they've been accused of having fallen asleep in their car at a Wendy's drive-thru. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And so that's the problem. That is the issue at stake. And that's what we're having a national conversation about.
If it doesn't make any sense, how do we figure out what's actually happening there?
Well, what we know is happening is that police officers have been trained to use lethal force in ways that have huge costs to individuals, obviously, and most especially to African Americans, because at the end of the day, if a police officer can essentially discharge their weapon at the mere pretense of a physical altercation, which did precede him being shot, not to be unclear about that, then that is the problem. We have to change the rules of engagement. We have to lessen the scope of the legal justification for use of force. And so these punitive responses, as in the case that's happened here in Atlanta, are the short-term answer. But the longer-term answer is that officers have to fundamentally be limited in their capacity to use force.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms points out a disconnect between the public and the police. Let's listen to what she said.
What has become abundantly clear over the last couple of weeks in Atlanta is that while we have a police force full of men and women who work alongside our communities with honor, respect, and dignity, there has been a disconnect with what our expectations are and should be as it relates to interactions with our officers and the communities in which they are entrusted to protect.
Is that what's happening in our country, Khalil?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she said it very well. I mean, to scan out, let's move from the specifics of the legal justifications for uses of force, which govern behavior at this current moment, to a broader scope. So if you're an African American living in Atlanta and the police are there to serve and protect you, the breakdown that we're watching is that those residents are saying, we don't want our citizens to be shot over things like this. Like, it's that simple. So in a democratic society, particularly where police are governed by local laws and where police claim to be serving the interests of the communities they serve, it shouldn't take this kind of continuous demonstration of that disconnect, because police clearly are not accountable to those community members. And that's true both in Atlanta and all over the United States. And it's been true from the very beginning.
We're talking with Khalil Muhammad, who teaches history at Harvard Kennedy School. And there's a line for you in this conversation about the history and the current role of police. You can call 800-642-1234. Where do you see the discrepancies in the way that police treat people? Have you had an interaction that was good or that didn't turn out as well as you had hoped? What do you think we can change? Let us know at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Khalil, you just called to this. Policing has been part of America since before we were even officially established as an independent nation. How did the first police forces get their start?
Well, the oldest policing in the United States, whether we look in New England or in the South, was quite anemic and minimal by comparison to today. A lot in places like New England was about social control of people who stepped out of community norms. There was concern about arson because everything was made of wood. And so you had night watchmen in places around Boston and Massachusetts in these very old colonies. And in the South, you had similar concerns, but primarily the focus was on the enslaved population. And within pretty short order, by the late 1600s, early 1700s, various laws that were defined as slave codes or slave acts prohibited the gathering of African Americans, three or more, in congregation. They empowered a local group of men who usually served about a year of duty as a member of a slave patrol. They had captains of these patrols. This included propertied men as well as landless men. They were empowered to monitor the roadways and back roads of the plantation economy. The fundamental concern was insurrection, rebellion, runaways, fugitives. And this was the infrastructure that captured the vast majority of quote-unquote law enforcement for 200 years prior to the founding of the nation and continued during the antebellum period.
So you talked about how policing at that point was about dealing with people who stepped outside of societal norms, and societal norms governed by white people, so that automatically set the standard against people of color.
Well, sure. I mean, there's no golden era or mythical period in policing history when policing was fair, that the wealthy and the influential, the ministers and the men of commerce were subjected to the same kind of policing as the landless and the poor or indigent, no matter whether you were white or indigenous or of African descent. That's been true from the very beginning. The scale of the racial control of policing in the South, where 90% of the Black population resided until roughly the 20th century, meant that the clear role of law enforcement to subjugate and control Black people was much, much more in stark contrast in the South as compared to places where there were fewer Black people.
We are talking with Khalil Muhammad, who teaches history at Harvard Kennedy School, and you are part of this conversation about policing, what it looks like, where it started, and where we go from here. And we're wondering, do you think we need to reframe what the police's purpose is? Have you already seen the effect of protests happening right now on the way that police departments are operating? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, wondering if you've taken part in protests over the killing of unarmed African Americans by police, and where you see discrepancies in the way that police are treating different kinds of people. Do you want lawmakers to step in? That phone number again is 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the role of police in our society. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest stays with us this hour. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Protesters have responded with outcry as they learned about George Floyd. And yet we say his name along with so many others. Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Tamir Rice, Tony McDade, Tatiana Jefferson, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin. Black men and women who died at the hands of officers, law enforcement who swear to protect and serve. Our guest is Khalil Muhammad, who teaches about race, inequality, criminal justice, and democracy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Khalil, we hear those names that I just read. That list is absolutely incomplete, and it does just keep growing. How did these statistics, these police statistics, become the measure of how Black people are faring in this country?
Well, that's a really great question. One has to really think about all of these questions in historical context. So, you know, here we are in the 21st century, looking back to our history, and everyone from Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas to Attorney General William Barr to even Donald Trump himself, acknowledging that America's history of slavery and segregation was a terrible chapter in our history. And therefore, you know, we've grown past that. I think Attorney General Barr referred to ever since the 1960s, we've been working on reform. So if you take them at face value, and not just someone like me, whose expertise is bound up in this work, then what we know is that policing, going back to slavery through the period of segregation in the early 20th century, and especially in the North and the South, was a form of racial control. So if we establish that policing looks a lot like it used to look, then we could surmise that policing itself is a system that is still in desperate need of rebuilding, of starting over, of defunding, of reform. I mean, there's a lot of words we could debate the actual meaning of, but that's essentially the conversation we're having. And when I look at police statistics in light of the names you just cited, I think about, like others, lynching victims, because lynching victims were people whose lives not only were cut short by vigilantes, but often police officers participated, stood watch, or simply refused to arrest any of the killer. Sometimes 10,000 people would gather. Tickets would be sold for excursions on trains to go to a scheduled lynching. We have no evidence that of the nearly 4,400 recorded lynchings in the country between the 1880s and 1950, we have no evidence that anyone was ever prosecuted. And thousands of people died, and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, participated in those, of which law enforcement aided and abetted that violence. So why should we think about the names of people today in terms of police statistics that both show us that white men, as was true in Georgia and New Brunswick a few weeks ago, can kill a Black man in broad daylight? And what do the police do? Nothing, until Black people go out and protest. Police officers themselves, like Derek Chauvin, can literally kill a person who never resisted, was already in handcuffs in broad daylight, looks a lot like a public lynching. And it's not just my perspective on it. It's what the citizens of that neighborhood and Minneapolis are calling it. So the question is, do Black people's citizenship and their definitions of their own victimization count in our democracy? And that is not, the answer has not been yes for most of this history.
You have say that white ethnic men, even in history, had a role in driving up crime in Black communities. That contributes to that information, that data, too. How did that work?
Well, that's a really great question. You've done your homework. So it's totally counterintuitive. On one hand, everybody gets a sense like if the police are corrupt, then they're not helping the situation when there's an underground economy. For most people, the era of Prohibition and Al Capone and all of those white ethnic gangsters that have been sensationalized in movies is a perfect example of this. What people don't know is that a lot of the underground economy, the bootlegging economy of the Prohibition era, was deliberately regulated in Black communities. So again, the typical American learns about the great jazz age of the 1920s. Alongside, to some degree, they might learn a little bit about Prohibition as also a great crime wave. But if you think of it as the jazz age, therein lies the actual story the intersection of white vice, both in terms of who's controlling things and also who's participating in it, and the proximity to Black culture and Black communities. 80 to 90% of speakeasies in the United States during the Prohibition era were operated and owned by white people in collaboration with police agencies that were thoroughly corrupt, which is why Prohibition was a gigantic disaster. And guess who showed up in the newspaper as being responsible for much of this? Black people, because a lot of it was happening in places like Harlem, in the Tenderloin district of Chicago or Kansas City or New Orleans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's an incredible part of this history because at the end of the day, it drove up the evidence of Black criminality, fueled racist ideas about Black people as a natural race of criminals, and contributed directly to more segregation and more discrimination of African Americans.
Khalil Muhammad wrote the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. We're talking about the history of policing and how it is entangled with race. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Brad from Eau Claire, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, Brad. What's on your mind?
I'd like to say, first off, that Khalil, I agree with everything you said. I'm a middle-aged white man, and I realized all of the atrocities committed against not only the Black people, but the Indians before that is just, it's unbelievable. And there's the only way you're going to stop this police brutality is to take legal action, pass a law, mandatory body cams for all police officers. Otherwise, their arrests are no good. They can't arrest anybody without a body camera on, and they have to submit the tapes daily to an internet database that's under public scrutiny daily. And if they do that, that'll solve a lot of the problem.
Brad, thank you for raising the issue. We're circling back to evidence here, Khalil, and Brad saying if you don't have that evidence, he doesn't think there's a whole lot we can do.
Well, I think Brad's absolutely right that video evidence has definitely changed the capacity to hold officers accountable. Derek Chauvin, the primary suspect in the killing of George Floyd, the person who was most visible and had his knee on the neck of George Floyd, not only was clearly being videoed, but he lied on the official police record. I mean, literally, he went back and the three other officers made up, fabricated a story about George Floyd. So to Brad's point, were it not for the fact that there were all these cameras, there were at least three different angles to see what happened to George Floyd, then we would be reliant on the official documentation, which frankly has been the way that this has happened until the last 10 years, because the vast majority of African-American suspects who were killed in controversial circumstances when community members said that's not how it happened, were dismissed. To be frank, and we don't have enough time to unpack this, Michael Brown, the circumstances of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Missouri, were disputed by several community residents. If you look in the DOJ report on the Michael Brown case, they essentially acknowledged that community members disputed the official account, but they dismiss them as being uncredible. The problem is that many of the police officials who arrived on the scene right after Michael Brown was killed said something very different than what Darren Wilson said later on to the grand jury and what became the official narrative. So there was a lack of credibility on both sides. But because there was no videotape, the Department of Justice, as well as the grand jury, sided with the official police record. So that's what's been happening. Whenever there is doubt, the official police record becomes the official statement because there's no way to disprove it. And video evidence has completely changed the calculus there. But it's not enough because clearly some officers are still willing to kill people even in plain view of cameras.
Khalil Muhammad studies race, democracy, inequality, and criminal justice in modern U.S. history. And we are talking about the role of police in our modern society and where these ideas that we operate on came from sometimes centuries ago. And we're taking your call at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see when it comes to lawmakers stepping in? Do you think that passing laws will change this, or something else needs to happen? Where do you see discrepancies in the way that police treat different people? What is your experience? Now is the time to share it with us as we talk about policing for this hour of the morning show. 800-642-1234 is the number you can use. You can also write it down. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. News is next. We know that policing is a question on the top of all of our minds. We're likely to hear more about the latest incidents in Wisconsin and beyond here, and we'll keep talking about it on the morning show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. This is a conversation about policing in America. We're talking about centuries-old influences on our systems and how we operate right now with our guest, Khalil Muhammad, who studies race, democracy, inequality, and criminal justice in modern U.S. history. He teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School. And John from Green Bay is ready to talk with us. Good morning, John.
Good morning. There's a gentleman named George Kelling, a Harvard graduate, PhD, who wrote a book some years ago called Fixing Broken Windows. The theory was that if you fix things before they get out of hand, they don't get out of hand. His example was to place a very nice car on a street in the Bronx. And the car was just beautiful, and it sat there weeks. Nobody touched it. Then they broke the windshield out of it. Within 2 days, the car had completely stripped. His point was this: there's a difference between policing something and law enforcement. The modern police force is engaged in law enforcement. When the law is broken, they step in and try and get the miscreants and do whatever is necessary. Policing is a matter of doing the things necessary to keep people from breaking the law. And it's very effective. When we were in summer camp as kids, every morning, first thing we had to do was police the camp, which meant go out and pick up the stuff that was broken and fixed and rake the leaves and make our beds. We policed the place and kept it the way it was supposed to be. They didn't wait until everything was damaged, then punish us as campers and send us home.
All right, John, thank you for raising that that idea that there's a distinction between policing and how law enforcement works right now. Khalil Muhammad, your thoughts?
Sure. Well, so George is right that the theory of broken windows, which was first explained in a 1982 article with co-author James Q. Wilson for The Atlantic, and has subsequently been revised and extended, basically was a theoretical argument, which is that signs of disorder breed disorder. And so police officers ought to see disorder as an early warning system and to identify perpetrators of that disorder so as to make sure that real crime didn't happen. The irony is that when they first articulated this idea, they noted that this would not work if police officers used their authority and discretion in a racist or discriminatory way. They saw that as an impediment to the theory being effective. And so, of course, that's what happened. What became the implementation of broken windows we call today stop, question, and frisk, zero tolerance policing, hotspot policing, CompStop policing. All of it was an effort to shift police resources towards crime prevention rather than simply catching the perpetrator or the suspect after a crime had been committed. But what does that mean, practically speaking? So let me analogize this. This would be the equivalent of TSA saying, well, we pretty much know that the people who are most likely to do something on a plane are of Arab ancestry, look Muslim, whatever that means. And so everybody else gets to go through. Well, TSA doesn't do that because that would violate our constitutional norms. Because just because I live in a community where there is disorder, just because everyone in my community is black, doesn't mean that presumptively I'm a criminal and therefore subject to some kind of tax or supervision or coercive treatment, like, where are you going? Do you belong here? Show me your ID. Stop. I need to ask you some questions. Well, that's what broken windows turned into. And it's a violation of people's civil liberties. White people would never stand for it if they felt like they were being targeted. Just like in TSA, when you go to the airport, if all of a sudden we decided that we're only going to stop this group of people, that would be a violation of the individuals who are represented by that group. And people seem to have a hard time understanding that, but that's why these things don't work.
This is part of what we hear when people say systemic racism, that this is part of the system and we've seen it play out in a racist way.
That's right. So, you know, again, everyone within the sound of this conversation doesn't know that much about New York necessarily, but New York has the largest police force in the United States. It's one of the oldest police communities in the United States. It professionalized in the 1840s. And so it's been an innovator. Between Newark and New York is where Stop and Frisk really took off in the 1990s. In New York, under Michael Bloomberg, for over 10 years, Stop and Frisk was accelerated to a scale never before seen. 4.4 million people stopped, 90% of whom were African American or Latino. 10% were not, were white. What did they find? 10% of all those stops produced something akin to a summons or an arrest. Felony rates remained flat over the entire period, which meant it wasn't like felonies dropped during Stop and Frisk because it was working. What increased were misdemeanors. So they picked up people for disorderly conduct, for riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, for public intoxication. And at the end of the day, when they did discover drugs or guns, white men were twice as likely as black or brown men to have them on their person. So it was ruled in 2013 in a federal lawsuit a violation of constitutional rights for the citizens. I mean, it was unbelievable, but it was in the name of crime prevention. Treat entire communities as if everyone who lives there is a potential suspect by stopping them. Again, 90% of whom are not even guilty so much as a ticket or a summons, and in the meantime, celebrate this as some kind of wonderful reduction in crime. The truth is that crime fell everywhere beginning in the mid-1990s, including outside of the United States, even as violent crime had risen before that. There is no scientific consensus based on empirical evidence that that form of policing is directly attributable to crime rates and violent rates dropping in the United States of America, no matter how many times police officers claim credit for it.
Khalil Muhammad teaches about history, race, and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School, and we're talking about the state of policing now and what we can learn about how police departments were founded. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have your interactions been with police in your part of Wisconsin? Have you taken part in protests over the killing of unarmed black people by police? What should we talk about? What should we be thinking about as we all try to come together and figure out what could be broken and ways that we could fix those situations? 800-642-1234. Again, you can email ideas@WPR.org. Khalil, when you're talking about those officers who would stop people of color specifically in those situations, are you saying that those officers are bad people?
No, actually I'm not, because we have a false notion that only bad people do bad things and good people can't. So I don't know what they are. I don't know what's in their heart. I know what they were empowered to do, and I know what they were incentivized to do. What they were incentivized to do, based on showing productivity, all of us who have a job have to show evidence of work. And so what they were incentivized to do was to stop as many people who fit a particular description. What we learned in the New York case, because there was a federal lawsuit and there was depositions and there was evidence produced, was that black men between the ages of 14 and 21 were identified as primary suspects for being stopped. So, I mean, I don't know what your listeners, any listener could say, like, that's okay. because that means that any random 15-year-old is a would-be suspect. Well, that's exactly what the New York Police Department was engaged in. And this kind of behavior was happening in many, many other.
Khalil, we are talking about so many different aspects of policing right now, and we should address this idea of that having black officers on the force would automatically solve the problems that we are talking about. That feels like a broad brush.
Oh, sure it is. Well, first of all, having black officers has been around for about 100 years. The first black officer in New York was hired in 1911. The interesting thing about black officers, just to show you how racism works in America, is they couldn't police white communities for most of the 20th century. But white officers, no matter whether they were Irish or Italian, could police any part of the city. So that tells you something just about how racism was built into even the idea of who's on the force. But let me address this as clearly as possible. Black officers are governed by the same rules. They're governed by the same culture. And when they try to buck that culture, they often are ridiculed and alienated within police forces because on some hand, to some degree, they want the same kind of justice for victims of crime as police officers often say. That's why they do what they do. That's why they wear the badge. But the problem is that when police officers are enforcing obedience and control and in treating people as suspects when there's no evidence of crime, black officers often say, well, that's not what I signed up for. And then they have a choice. Either they fall behind the blue wall and keep their mouth shut, or they try to work on reform from within. And that's why we have organizations like NOBLE or 100 Black Men in Law Enforcement. But we don't hear a lot about these organizations in the national conversation. Why? Because they've never been embraced. They're treated like traitors to the blue wall of silence or to the Blue Lives Matter ethos that exists in our police departments. Now, on the question of police chiefs are subjected to the same rules and regulations that govern policing. So some of them actually try to change them, like David Brown in Dallas, who was there during the killings of police officers, who's now the police chief of Chicago. But many of them are not people who were selected to come in and transform it. They were selected to be a representation of diversity and little more. There's also a culture among black police officers, whether rank and file or police chiefs, that is a punitive culture. That's partly why people are attracted to policing in the first place. They want to get the bad guys. They don't have time for the nuances of people and the complexities of communities. And so they don't have attitudes that are any different than the kind of the most abusive kinds of tough guy cops that we see, you know, in any community.
We're talking about policing in America with Khalil Muhammad, who's a professor of history, race and public policy. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Where do you think we go from here? How do you want to see lawmakers stepping in? How do you want to see departments embrace reform? 800-642-1234. Maybe you have a story that demonstrates something that needs to change and you're willing to share it with us. You can call us at 800-642-1234. I'm Keeley Boltina. This conversation continues right here on The Morning Show. Advocates used yellow paint. They formed huge block letters down Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Madison. The state capitol building loomed over the words defund police. Whether you find that idea a threat or an opportunity depends on your relationship with law enforcement. And because we live in a society where white experiences are considered the norm, narratives that fall outside of that default, they're questioned. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and there's still time for your questions at 800-642-1234. We're talking about policing with Khalil Muhammad, who studies race, democracy, inequality, and criminal justice in modern U.S. history. He teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School. Defunding the police, that's among the changes that protesters want to see made in response to the killing of black people by police. Khalil, what does defunding the police mean to you?
Sure. Well, what it means to me is that you begin to look at what police officers shouldn't be doing because they don't do it very well. And the truth is, I mean, I have had the unique experience of sitting down with police chiefs. I spent some time with him about a year and a half ago in Montgomery, Alabama, at a convening of reformers who were really interested in how can they inspire change in their own departments and elsewhere. And one of the...
Oh, Khalil, you've cut out just a bit. We're talking with Khalil Muhammad, who studies race and inequality and criminal justice, also wrote a book. And we are talking about policing here in America. And Khalil's book is called The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. And Khalil, we're talking about the concept of defunding police and taking money away from areas where you say police are not very good at these specific things and maybe someone else could be doing that work.
Yeah, just to finish the point, Charles Ramsey, who led President Obama's 21st Century Task Force back in 2016, he and many, many others say, look, we've been asked to take on everything that isn't working in our society. So the range of things that people have needs for public goods and public support for, people are picking up the phone and saying, call the police. In my own community, a local police officer recently said that they get calls from elderly residents saying, can you take us to the grocery store? So in a society where the public sector has been shrinking and we've been saying nobody wants to pay taxes for anything, means that we don't have the range of social services that would promote health and welfare and safety in our communities. And police officers have been doing that work. So I don't want to sound like a crazy lunatic to suggest that police officers are just, you know, categorically just terrible people, although they do have a system they've inherited that is anti-Black and anti-poor. Nevertheless, the defund movement says, since we know that police officers are being asked to do too much, since police admit that they've been asked to do too much, then let's take a lot off their plate. Let's take the nuisance calls off their plate. Let's take the wellness checks off their plate. Let's even look at how they can work with violence interrupters who are community-based public health workers who do conflict resolution and do a really good job at it. Because police officers have about a 50% clearance rate in some of the communities that experience the greatest numbers of murders. That is a failing grade. So they don't have trust. They come in and treat everybody like suspects. And so even on a question of violence, police officers can give up some of their resources to help proven community-based methods that actually save people's lives. It's also true on the matter of rape, which is the kind of thing that people say, well, people are going to get raped. There'll be no police. Well, the problem with that is that the number of rapes that result in convictions based on police activity is 1%. Not to mention that police officers commit acts of sexual violence that are not caught on body cameras and videotapes precisely because these things happen in the dark when no one is around. So we have so much evidence for why every local community of 18,000 police agencies need to sit down with elected officials, movement leaders, and other traditional community pillars and hammer out a new set of practices, procedures for what the police should be doing. And my guess is that they'll come up with a smaller footprint that works best for everyone.
We are talking with our guest, who is Khalil Muhammad, studies race, democracy, criminal justice, and inequality through the lens of U.S. modern history. And we now have Elna from Madison who wants to join our conversation. Hi, Elna.
Good morning. I think the easy availability of guns, both legal and illegal, escalates the likelihood of violence in all encounters. Police assume that suspects are armed. Could you address gun control, please?
Thanks, Elna. Khalil, the role of firearms.
Yeah, just very quickly. Listen, the Second Amendment protects it. No politician has suggested that we roll back the way that the Supreme Court has substantiated the right of Americans to have maximum access to handguns and other lethal weapons, including military grade. So yes, short answer, we are armed to the teeth, something like 400 million guns in our population, more than one gun for every American. And to some degree, sure, police often feel that way, but they're supportive of the NRA, not uniformly, but many of them are. Their president, who they supported, the Fraternal Order of Police, is a gun advocate. So this is a cultural problem as much as anything else. And I don't need to tell Elna that adding the gun control problem onto the police problem, you know, would make my head explode. So we need a whole lot more people to decide what if they want fewer guns in the United States of America.
And certainly the idea of the potential of someone being armed contributes to the calculation that police make when they're determining what use of force is appropriate. How much discretion do officers have?
They have maximum discretion. I mean, that's what's so evident here. I mean, obviously what we're seeing precisely in this moment is that when there's evidence that they had no reason to be fearful, some of them are being punished. The person who killed Walter Scott in North Charleston a few years ago, who literally shot him in the back, would have gotten away with that had it not been for a citizen video tape. So did he have the right to shoot a man fleeing in the back over warrants for outstanding child support payments? I mean, like, was it evident that Walter Scott didn't have a gun? Yes. Someone in California was killed who was naked, completely naked, in the middle of the street, was shot dead by the police. So they have maximum discretion when they claim fear so far, but that's changing. That's breaking down, because when that fear seems unjustified because there is contrary evidence to what they're claiming, then it's changing.
Khalil, you've argued that for decades, alternative policy visions for policing have been rejected. Those policies, some of which could have done more to achieve racial justice. What were some of those policy visions? Why did they fail?
Well, the earlier policy visions were that police officers ought to be prosecuted vigorously when they break the law, just as any citizen would be subject to criminal sanction. Again, we know that the vast majority of police officers have not been prosecuted, even when there's the appearance of impropriety. So those claims for reform go back 100 years, and they were repeated decade after decade through a number of Blue Ribbon Commission reports starting in Chicago. And then we have these pattern and practice investigations starting in the 1990s. So from the 20s to the present, the notion that police officers ought to be punished by criminal sanction when they break the law has been something that hasn't been a reform that's been widely embraced. The second is that citizen review boards were called for, again, going back to the 1920s, under the understanding that if police are more accountable to the communities they actually serve, then they will behave differently. But citizen review boards have been blocked time and time again. Many of them have been set up as kangaroo operations that are not really about justice, but the appearance of procedural justice. And so that remains work to be done. Here in where I live in New Jersey, the Newark police have been subjected to a consent decree that called for a vigorous and effective citizen review board that is now sitting on the Supreme Court docket of the state of New Jersey. Why? Because the union opposes it, because police officers themselves don't want the kind of accountability that would open them up to public scrutiny. So those are just two of the reforms that have failed time and time again to change policing.
Khalil, thank you for breaking it down for us.
Thanks for having me on.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. He looks at the intersection of democracy and race, inequality, and criminal justice in modern U.S. history. And we have been talking about policing, how we handle policing in this modern age, and how some of the practices have roots deep into even before our country was formed. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.